this week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, we are joined by the executive director and founder of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition to speak about programs, community outreach, biased opinions, and misconceptions about the Muslim faith. Join us on civicmedia.us or wherever you find your podcasts. And please remember to like, share, subscribe so you never miss your favorite episodes. Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. Once again, it is my pleasure and distinct honor to introduce my next guest. And I'll tell you, you know, as an American citizen born and raised in this nation, and, you know, being a black man in this nation, I kind of see things through a different prism, I think, than a lot of Americans, because, you know, being born and raised here, sometimes you think it equates to equality, in that everything that our nation professes to be. As a young man growing up in the 50s and the 60s and watching the battle that took place in order for there to be an opportunity for people of color to get a chance to have equality in a nation that professes to be the number one nation in the world that opens the doors for everybody. And equality is certainly one of the things that we've always said was a sticking point for the United States. I realized that that wasn't always so. And so for there to be equality and freedom and justice is about more than just words, right? The Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, those are words. But if they're not put into practice, then they don't mean, you know, as much to those of us who have suffered because of those things. And so my guest that I'm bringing to you today, Mr. Janan Najib, is a pioneering Muslim community leader, advocate, and educator, widely recognized for her work at the intersections of faith, justice, and civic engagement. She is the founder and executive director of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition, which operates Our Peaceful Home, a culturally specific domestic violence and family strengthening program, and the Islamic Resource Center, Wisconsin's first Muslim library and cultural hub. Najib has founded several groundbreaking initiatives, including the Wisconsin Muslim Civic Alliance, the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival, and the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. Now, she's worn many hats and many titles, but I think I have to read on so you get an idea of the magnitude and the majesty of the person that I have the honor and privilege to interview this morning. She also serves on the Governor's Council on Domestic Abuse and holds board positions with the Rotary Club of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Public Radio, and the Wisconsin Historical Society. She chairs both the Religious Leaders Caucus of MICA and the City of Milwaukee Commission on Community Wellness and Safety. For more than two decades, she has also co-chaired and emceed Milwaukee Citywide Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration. A frequent media voice and public speaker, Najib has delivered more than 2,000 presentations across the country on Muslim identity, civil rights, women's rights, refugees, and the interfaith dialogue. Her published works include contributions to the Journal of the Middle East, Women's Studies, and the Journal of Disability and Religion, as well as book chapters and training manuals for statewide agencies. She is frequently featured in major outlets, including the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the New York Times, Islamic Horizons, and Wisconsin Public Radio. Her trailblazing leadership has earned her numerous awards, including the 2024 Milwaukee Magazine Women of Distinction Award, the 2023 Lucille Barron Humanitarian Award, the 2022 Milwaukee Rotary Person of the Year Award, and the 2019 Frank Zeidler Award of Social Justice and Activism, among many others. So, you know, I don't know if I went on any further, we wouldn't have any time to do this this presentation. But I want to say welcome. It is an honor and a privilege to have an opportunity to speak with you on this platform.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for making me look so good.
You've done that yourself.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here and to spend this time with you and the guests.
You know, I want to just add that I've also had your brother on many times over the years. The bloodlines that you and your brother have inherited. I mean, your parents, mother and father. Let's talk a little bit about your origin, how you got here, how your parents got here, and then we can get into all those other things. We have to start at the beginning.
You know, although I was born in Palestine and came here as a three-year-old, in some ways I sometimes feel that I'm a third generation, because it actually started with my grandfather coming from Palestine as, at that time, they were merchants. They would bring some of the Oriental carpets and they would bring different things here and they come by ship. And my grandfather, one of his spots was Milwaukee, interestingly. And then my father came to join his father, my grandfather, when he was, I think, 15 or 16 years of age, to continue his education here and to go on to college. But a year after arriving, my grandfather died. So my grandfather is actually buried here in Milwaukee. And interestingly, my father, how long has it been now? It's been like 9-10 years that he was visiting Palestine and he got sick and he died and he's buried in Palestine. So it's very interesting how things happen. But we grew up in Milwaukee. We were a family with, my parents, and then we are four siblings. And we grew up with a very strong sense of identity. My parents were very proud Palestinians, very proud Muslims in really a city and a community that didn't understand who Palestinians or Muslims were. My father spent much of his time as a young person before he had gotten married, actually in the with the Black Muslim community, who he found a lot of camaraderie and understanding, because as people of color and as individuals that were not seen as part of mainstream society, regardless. And so he, for the longest time as growing up, this was a community we worked very, very closely with and we were part of. And so we grew up with a strong sense of identity. My father and mother were always very involved in the community. And I remember whenever students would come from overseas, our house was almost like a little hotel, it seemed, because my father remembered his early beginnings as a young man that had no family here. And so he really had a place in his heart for students that would come and not have family. And so growing up, our house was almost an international hub, it felt like. We always had people over sharing dinner or staying at our house. My father was one of the founders of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. He was also very active in trying to educate and keep the issue of Palestine alive, because it's a modern day case of, you know, it's a situation of colonialism. It's apartheid. It's injustice. and he wanted to make sure that we grew up knowing that and understanding our roots and not forgetting that and educating others. And I think that as growing up in a household like that, an activist household, we didn't know any other way to live.
Your brother, Okmanata, who is a fierce defender of Palestinians in this state, is, you know, I have nothing but admiration for him. And over a couple decades now, I guess it's been since I've had him for the first time when I was on a different radio station. But he is, in fact, prideful. Let's talk a little bit about the Palestinian reality, because people in this country don't know much about Palestine. They clearly hear some things about the Palestinian people. But let's begin by talking about who the Palestinians are.
The Palestinians are Arab. We are one of the Arab nations. And I think that, you know, we live amongst now that really it's 22 Arab countries that were kind of divided by colonialist rule. But we're part of the Levant area, what's known as the Levant area, where it's Palestine and Jordan and Lebanon and Syria. I think that what people often don't know, this is a very rich culture. It's a culture that goes back centuries. It's also Palestine. It has always consisted of Muslims, Christians, Jews, overwhelmingly Muslims, but also Palestinian Christians and a small percentage of Palestinian Jews. But then during the pogroms in Europe and after the Holocaust, and actually previous to the Holocaust, because there had been a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe, Great Britain, which at the time was one of the major colonialist powers, decided that they were going to push forth the idea of creating a homeland for European Jews in the Arab world, in Palestine, without, of course, asking the Palestinians. And I think it's the absolute epitome of anti-Semitism when you want to get rid of your citizens and send them to another country because you feel that they will be safer there. So the problem was that the Palestinians, as are the Arabs, as are overwhelmingly the Muslims, you know, thought that these are just immigrants that are coming and suffering from oppression, and they open their doors. But what happened is that many of these groups had particular terrorist groups like the Irgun and others that really terrorized Palestinians, chased them from their home to make room for the European Jews. Over 800,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed, many killed and massacred and murdered. So this unjust system continues to this day. So now you have Palestinians who are continuously being massacred and killed and living under a very, very brutal apartheid system, and many of their homes and lands being taken over by European, American, Russian, even Ukrainian Jews. And unfortunately, our government has continued to support this.
So let me ask you, why did not other Arab brethren come to the rescue or to the support of the Palestinians when this was starting to take place?
Well, there were efforts, and there had been a few wars that that were fought. But we have to understand that the Arab countries had been kind of divided by colonialists, and so it's not as if they had leadership and armies that were really established.
Right.
And they did come to the help of the Palestinians in many ways, because those hundreds of thousands of refugees to this day live in Jordan, live in Lebanon, live in Syria, live in Egypt. And so many of them continue to live there. But it's not the responsibility of these countries who are, you know, we're really developing countries in some ways, to take on such a responsibility of feeding and housing hundreds of thousands of individuals, just so Israel and Europe can Europe can get rid of their Jewish citizens. And so, you know, that was another thing that came about even over these last 2 years of the genocide, where people have been saying, well, why don't they go to the Arab world? Why should they go to the Arab world? That's not, you know, they live in Palestine. These are the Palestinians. Why does that make sense to tell the Palestinians that they should go leave their homes and their lands that they have lived for centuries on, and make it available for European and American Jews and Russian Jews that have really no connection? Some of these people are converts, agnostics, whatever the case is, but they have no connection. Their DNA is not of that area. These are individuals that came from other parts of the world.
So Palestinians, unfortunately, have not been able to tell their side of this story globally. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I think it's because Palestinians are a newer immigrant to the United States. I think that the Jewish community has a much longer history here in the United States, and because they are European, they were seen as you know, part and parcel of the whole European entities that have come to make up the United States here. And so I think that they have been able to establish a narrative that they have sold to the American people. And the Palestinians, being newer immigrants, were not able to really, didn't have the capability and the influence to be able to do that. And then we have also the probably over the past couple of decades are that the newer force of fundamentalist Christians, the kind of like the mega Christians now, known as the mega Christians, where they have been convinced that that it is a requirement for Jews to all move to Israel in order for the Messiah to come back and Armageddon to take place. So they have their own vision of what they imagine needs to happen. As if, you know, this land was somehow promised to the Jews. So they basically turned God into a real estate broker, you know, who promises land to groups of people based on ethnicity rather than piety, which is a really racist concept. But I think there are two things that first of all, that narrative has been pushed in churches and in certain you know, places through the media, and the Palestinians have really not been able to get their voices out there.
You know, it is more than frustrating. As I stated before, a year or so or more ago, when the assault in Gaza was taking place, and there were protests in university campuses all over the world and all over this nation. And even in Milwaukee at UWM, I went down because what was being said was that college students were being misled and that they were naive and that they didn't know what really was taking place. And so for those college students who were pushing against and created what they called tent cities across this nation, and I just wouldn't accept that college students, which are pretty bright young people, they don't get into universities by not being bright, somehow would be misled and because they were able to discern for themselves what was taking place. And so they were, again, the conversation was that they were being misled. So I went down and introduced myself to a lot of those who were leading the tent cities. And I wasn't surprised because I already knew that those young people who were fighting for what is right, you know, just a different group of young people than the young people during the civil rights struggles and others who saw injustice and were fighting against that. And so I brought a couple of them on the air, and we had conversations about what was taking place. And it was always, you know, concerning to me that in a nation that says we have a freedom of speech, a freedom of religion, and that our nation is about, you know, open dialogue, that you couldn't have a conversation with Palestinians. Okay, it's like you can't do that. And so it's one of the reasons why, I mean, even today, I know many Muslims, I know many Palestinians, good people, really, really good people. And yet, you know, there are people who don't know Palestinians and Muslims because they've been led to believe that you guys are something different and that you guys don't, you know, aren't like regular Americans who apparently love God and love one another. Well, that's not the case. You know, I've got so many Muslim friends and Palestinian friends. I don't judge people based on, you know, their economic or you know, where their origin is. I think that's a major problem that we have in this nation, that we decide to pick and choose the ethnicity of someone who we can befriend. And so what do you say as, again, a person who basically spent your entire life in this nation, to what we see happening, even against all those different things, again, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, which doesn't apparently include certain people?
I think we have to look at our country, and I think we have to recognize that our country, the largest industry in our country is armaments.
Yes.
And so if you create and build and supply and sell armaments, you need wars. That's basically what you need. And so we need, in order to have wars, you need to create enemies. And if people recognize the others as people just like them, with families, etc., it's difficult to sell a war to your country. But when you make them really subhuman, when you make them as the other, when you use words like terrorist, when you use words like they don't, when you make statements like they don't believe in the same God as we do, when you use these types of ways to define a group of people, it makes it easier for people to see an enemy. I think about the Iraq War. imagine the war that killed over a million people and then millions more after the war for absolutely nothing. For the supposed weapons of mass destruction that did not exist. So we do these types of things, and it's the same thing with the Palestinians. The efforts to really demonize the students that were doing the encampment was simply because it was well known. That's what happened in the Vietnam War. It started at the universities. The people that were objecting to it. And so if the narrative gets out that what is happening in Gaza and what has been happening for nearly eight decades in Palestine is a case of brutal apartheid and colonialism, it's a subjugation of an indigenous people, people are not going to be so supportive of sending billions of dollars of our tax dollars to Israel every year while, you know, normal Americans can't even put food on their table, they can't even get adequate health care, et cetera. So we have to create that kind of enemy. And so all of the silencing that has been taking place with students being kicked out of universities, with individuals who post things even on their personal social media about Palestine, being kicked out of their places of work. We've seen so many individuals in the media that have been let go. Why? Because they're promoting understanding, and that's not what works. That is not what our government, both Democrat and Republican, have wanted, because we really, our industry is our economy is built on armaments. And also we have got some very, very powerful lobbies in this country. One of the most powerful lobby in this country has been AIPAC, the Israeli lobby. And so their control over many people in positions of politics, our government, in the media, has really served to silence the narrative of the Palestinians and to only present the narrative of the Israelis. And now that we're seeing some of the things that are really coming out with the Epstein files and how people have been controlled also, you know, by Israel, I think people need to start waking up and seeing how they are being really brainwashed to understand only a certain narrative, and it's been at their expense and the expense of our country.
You know, you can look at what is transpiring with immigrants coming here from Mexico and other places, and they have been vilified. And so you constantly hear people calling them criminals and all sorts of things, and throwing everybody into the same category, even if they're people who've come here and not committing any crimes and supporting this nation and came here for all the reasons that Europeans came to this nation. And yet, because they painted this picture of them being lawless and criminals, it unfortunately is justified in the treatment and the mishandling of mothers and children. And we see all of this before our eyes. We know it's not right. We know it's wrong. And yet it continues to happen. And so it has been with the Palestinians. So for people who don't know what a Muslim is, they hear Muslim and they have no concept at all of what a Muslim is, only that they don't believe the same religious beliefs that people who call themselves Christians. But the last time I checked, America is made up of all different beliefs, religious beliefs, and for whatever reason, Muslims seem to be one that has been picked out as one that are evildoers. So what's a Muslim?
Well, let me first kind of start with the last part that you said, that, you know, Muslims have sort of been picked out. I think one of the reasons is because so many of the wars that have been launched have been in Muslim countries, you know, so you continue to create that that entity that people cannot identify with or sees as the other, you know, as sees as less than, sees as less than human. I do think that slowly things are changing, at least in cities and in places where you know, there's a more substantial number of Muslims. Islam is one of the three Abrahamic faiths that really you know, look at Abraham as being the father.
Right.
So whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, we all hail from, you know, look at Abraham as being
the same origin, right?
Yeah, the same origin. As Muslims, we also believe that, you know, we believe in the God of Abraham. So if Christians or Jews don't believe in the God of Abraham, then we are different religion, very different. But if we're all believing in the God of Abraham, then it's the same. It's the same God. Some of the differences, there are a lot of similarities, you know, even within the Quran, for example, we have an entire chapter dedicated to Maryam or Mary, the mother of Jesus. You know, we believe in Jesus and the virgin birth of Jesus. This is something that is the similarities between Muslims and Christians, for example. As Muslims, we believe that God doesn't beget nor is begotten. So God is just God. God doesn't have children, nor was God born. And so this is unique. We believe in a single monotheistic God, and this is something we share probably more with Jews than with Christians. We don't, as Muslims, we don't view God in finite terms. God, you know, we don't have images of God where he's got blonde hair, for example, or white hair, long white hair. We believe that God is beyond human description. So we believe God is being the creator of all. We have many of the similar moral codes. We have, you know, a lot of stories that are very similar. So where is this idea that Muslims somehow are different? I think again, it has a lot to do with political efforts. And from my own perspective, I think that it really that some of these are probably grounded in the idea of Palestine and Israel. You have within, for example, the Old Testament, as if you know, Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. We know that Ishmael was the eldest, but because his mother was an African handmaiden, he's not considered equal to Isaac, for example. But that's not something that Muslims believe. You know, we believe that the children of Abraham are equal, that just simply because of the social status of a mother does not change the equality between the children, because, you know, even if she had been a slave, for example, that's sort of like saying that slavery is a divine institution sanctioned by God. Absolutely not. So we need to recognize that sometimes some of this racism is really couched in religious language, and it starts there. You know, that's where sometimes it starts, and so that's where a lot of the Jewish and then also some of the fundamentalist Christian groups, where they say, well, you know, God promised a certain plot of land to the son of Abraham, and so the only legitimate son is Isaac. Well, who said that? You know what I mean? And so this is where they base then the idea that, oh, God promised this the land of Palestine to Jews 3,000 or I don't know how many years ago. And so supposedly ignoring all history, ignoring all of the different empires and peoples and groups that have lived in the land, as if, you know, you just have this group that just remained pure, and suddenly you're plopping them into Palestine. So I think it's really intentional. I think it's political, and it's promoted. It's promoted in some of the churches. It's promoted in different ways. And you know, the efforts then to alienate Muslims and make them seem inferior. That's part of where it started.
You know, Mrs. Najib, it is the ignorance of people not knowing, because I've always questioned the Jews, the Jewish religion, and the Christian religion. They've got the same book. The New Testament is the Christian Bible. The Old Testament is the Torah. And Jews don't believe the same thing that Christians believe. And yet, there you don't see that same kind of vitriol directed at the beliefs of Jews who don't believe in the Trinity. They don't believe that Jesus Christ was God. And yet, they don't have this adversarial relationship with one another. So people have different religious beliefs all over the world. And actually, you have a right to that. But I'm a person who just believes that people have a right to believe what they want to believe, you know, as you stated, you know, and yet because people aren't taught those things, and at the root of all of it is people's religious beliefs. People have fought, bled, and died over their religious beliefs when, you know, that's not what the Creator came here for, was to separate people because of their religious beliefs. And you talked about the fact that our nation, number one weapons developer and seller, and, you know, we only make up 4% of the global population, yet, you know, our expenditures on the military is more than the top 3 or 4 nations combined. Americans, if they knew, I think, some of the things, Sister Najib, that maybe things would be different, but you have to dig to find the information out that I'm talking about. It's not being taught daily. So people can make decisions themselves based on that information.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned that people have freedom to follow whatever the religion they want. I mean, we have significant number of people in our country here that don't believe in any religion, right? You know, and they have the right to believe or not believe, etc. But this is really the problem when you've got this type of racism that is directed at a particular religious group. It's not even so much that, you know, it's that particular religion, for example, but it's really the political aspirations of other groups. So you know you can't put into play Israel's plan of ethnically cleansing when you see Muslims as normal people. You know what I mean?
Right.
When you see Palestinians as normal people. And so it's all part of that political kind of way of designating people with in derogatory ways. And we saw this, I mean, and we continue to see this with now the as you mentioned, the Mexicans, for example. We've seen this with the Black community. We've seen this with the indigenous native community,
right?
You know, savages or whatever. these kind of designations. It's the same kind of playbook, just using different terminology to demonize
them. To your credit, you spent your life trying to heal this divide and witness all the different organizations that you've created and programs. You've created those to attempt to bridge the gap between people who should be treating human beings are all the same, okay? Born with a soul, born, last time I checked, for the most part, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two ears, heart, lung, all those things we've got more certainly in common than we have not in common. And you've worked very hard to try to bridge those things and witness all the different organizations and groups that you are interacting with. So you're not alone, right? I mean, there are coalitions of people who work in this nation and around the world to try to heal these wounds. Is it safe to say that?
I think absolutely. And I think that, you know, what I have found in my decades of work in this field is that there are those with sinister agendas, but the vast majority of people are honestly good people. They're just uninformed. They just have not had the opportunity to hear a different narrative. They have not had the opportunity to understand another perspective because they're limited in the number of TV stations. All I had to do these last 2 years is I've totally gotten off of all of the mainstream media because you know, when I've seen the way they have shown Palestinians as just like this massive unnamed group, whereas when they talked about like the Israeli hostages, they'd mention their names, they'd mention their families, they were people, they would show them as people. I mean, you came out of this thinking that the only important thing in Gaza were 20 hostages, not the hundreds of thousands that have been killed, not the 25,000 young children, Palestinian children that have been massacred. You know what I mean? So again, it's just being uninformed. So really, my experience is that to create opportunities, and many of the programs that I have tried to create and be involved with is to have those opportunities to allow people to interact and to get to know each other in a way that they're speaking for themselves, not other people are speaking about them, you know? So when people get to know each other, they realize that, wow, we have a lot of similarities. When I first started the Muslim Women's Coalition, one of the first projects we began with, this is like 30 years ago, is a women's Muslim Christian dialogue group. And that was incredible. That was phenomenal because you had so many Christian women that had never met a Muslim. You know,
right.
And after many years, you found we were talking about raising our children. We were talking about, you know, how we celebrated our holidays, how we worried about our children, you know, being safe in, and so many things that are really very, very similar. And there was such a sense of awe when the Christian woman would watch, for example, the Muslim woman get up and pray because it was time to pray, for example. I was probably invited to every year for many, many years, for decades. I was probably invited every year to at least 10 churches during Lent just to talk about Muslim fasting as a comparison to the Christian Lent, because they found It's so interesting to be able to talk about fasting in the different faiths in that way. So you create these opportunities for people to really get to know each other, and you find that hatred, which is usually based on fear, goes away, you know? But the ones that continue to want to promote it are the ones that have a political agenda behind it.
You know, sister, Najib, I remember constantly hearing about how mistreated Muslim women were and how Muslim men take advantage of Muslim women, and Muslim women don't have any freedoms at all. And I see you with your I forgot what you call your
Najab.
Yeah, Najab. And when I understood and I learned what the whole purpose of that was, I said, you know, more people need to hear the purpose of why Muslim women cover themselves. And there's wisdom behind it. And so what's at the root of it, from what I've learned, is, you know, when men look upon a woman and they see the physical nature of a woman and the physical beauty of a woman, they can get attracted solely because of that physical beauty and not get to know a woman by her mind first and who she is. And because of the evil consequences of time that kind of change all of us, you know, our physical stature that we have when we're young fades. And so if you fall in love with somebody for their mind and who they are before the physical aspects of it, it certainly makes more sense than falling in love with the physical aspects of somebody, which is definitely going to change. So as a Muslim woman who wears an hijab, will you explain that doesn't mean that somehow you are being mistreated by your religion?
Yeah, sure. So the hijab is really part of the entire modesty outfit. And I have to emphasize that modesty in Islam is not just for women. It's also for men. So if you go to like a mosque in the middle of August in the hot weather, the men are not in tank tops and shorts. You know, that's not how we dress modestly. And what I often find interesting to me is that, you know, you can also look at how men in many of the Muslim countries dress. Look at Pakistan, look at, you know, even in like some of the Gulf countries, etc., the kind of clothes that even the men wear. But nobody kind of points out, well, why are the men dressed modestly in that way? You know what I mean? So whereas there's the practical aspect that you talked about, you know, for women to be known and recognized for who they are, because, you know, people outside your family don't need to know what you look like physically. But I want to say that the most important reason why we wear the hijab is because we believe God commanded modesty. And one of our examples of modesty is Mary, the mother of Jesus, you know. I don't know any image that I have ever seen of her. She's always been covered, you know? And so she, to us, is the epitome of modesty and someone who has love and a strong connection with God. And I think that we have to get even beyond all of these to the concept of what is the purpose of our creation. So as Muslims, we believe the purpose of our creation is really to establish a good and just society on earth, and that's how we worship God. And we do it through our prayers, our five times a day, our constant connection with God. And so the aspect of modesty is simply also to us a reminder of what we represent and what our connection to God is, that we're not here simply to flaunt our beauty or to use it in ways, you know, that that is not acceptable, but really to always come back to our center. What is the purpose of our creation? What is our job here on earth? And that's you know, and modesty is part of that for both men and women. And I have to emphasize, because I'm always astounded how many people don't know that we don't wear our hijab in front of, you know, women. We don't wear our hijab in front of our, you know, male, immediate male relatives, our husbands, our sons, our brothers, etc., things like that. This is our outside attire. So it's a reminder to us of who we are, and hopefully a reminder to those who see us to maybe remember and think about God as well.
You know, Sister Najib, I have to say to you that we've kind of come to the end for now, but we've not even scratched the surface of the conversation and dialogue that I want to have with you, because the beginning of being able to see someone for who they are is to first listen to who they are, and then you can make determinations based on what you've heard. And so it's one of the reasons why I'm so honored to have you on for today, and we'll certainly come back. There's so much more to talk about, but I think we've just not even scratched the surface. But if nothing else, there are people who are listening today who have heard some things that they would have probably never heard before as it relates to what's taking place. And so I'm honored and privileged, and look forward to the second part of this as we continue to attempt to build some kind of dialogue. I've never understood, sister, we're here on this planet for just a short period of time. In the twinkling of an eye, we're gone. The fact that we are separated from one another the way we are is a travesty. And I don't care who your God is, that's not something he believed in. So this is our shortcomings as human beings. We've got to work at overcoming that. And the best way to do that is through dialogue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. Like you said, we barely got into the conversation, and I am more than happy to come back. And really, it's been an honor to be on your show.
Well, you will be coming back real soon. So thank you very much. And tell your brother, whom I have great admiration for, Mr. Okmanata, that I said hello, and I look forward to having dialogue with him as well. Thank you. Have a great time until I see you again.